Hi, everybody. Good morning. Can you hear me okay? Okay, I'm not convinced, but those up here, we sound very quiet. First, can I, if anyone was at the dinner we did on a similar topic last night, could you raise your hand so I just know if we have any overlap? Okay, cool. I'm Emily Holden. I'm editor-in-chief of Floodlight, and we're a nonprofit investigative news organization. We partner with local and national news outlets to tell stories about the corporations and the ideological interests that are fighting climate action, disinformation, greenwashing, and campaigns to influence public policy. And I think we're all going to give a little bit more of an introduction of like where we're from and how we got to our point in our career, because that's like pretty key to this conversation. I just want to talk a little bit about the foundation of, you know, how we've all decided what we understand as objectivity in journalism before we start. And we had a bit of a thought exercise on that last night. We had a dinner on the same topic, and I went around and asked each person to write down on a prompt, like, what is my job as a journalist in like one sentence, if you're trying to really condense it. And I think that's a great exercise for us to do here now and kind of think about as we're talking, but I won't ask us to take a break to do that. But I wrote down some of the words that people told me, because I think it's really critical to understand like what range of responsibilities we feel that we have. So a main one was inform, one was inspire, to tell the truth, to tell stories, to make people curious, to educate, to enchant, to enthrall, to speak truth to power, to fight disinformation, and to stand up for people who are more vulnerable than we are. And so I think that's really important for the beginning of this conversation, because I think underlying all of that are kind of three core principles. One is that the world has an unfair power structure. I think we pretty much agree with that for journalists. Two is that that power structure hurts people. And three is that it's our job to try to make that right, to make that fairer for people. So I think with that as kind of like the baseline of everything that we do, we know that we already do have an objective with our job. We have something that we're trying to achieve. And for me, that's something that I've been thinking about more and more over the past few years as I've transitioned to the kind of work that I'm doing. Because I think that we, you know, we have a responsibility not just to mirror the world, not just to tell people what's happening, but to be really unsparingly truthful about the severity of the climate crisis. And about the people who are causing it, and what they're benefiting, what they're getting out of it. So, just a moment here, and then I'll ask everyone to kind of introduce themselves. A couple of people have asked me about Floodlight and why I started it, why I left a really wonderful environmental news publication that has a great footprint on the beat, The Guardian, to do this. And for me personally, the reason I like to talk about this is that I got really bored with the kinds of stories that I was writing. I know that they're important to inform people, but I felt like, especially as a DC reporter, I was writing the same thing that like 15 other people were writing almost every day. You know, I was writing the same story about a regulation that came out or a speech about climate change that the president made or, you know, made on the campaign trail. And I felt like the more I was learning about the climate crisis and how bad it is, I was getting farther away from communicating that to people, right? I was just kind of like, just becoming part of that system and that like echo chamber, but not really reaching the people I wanted to reach. So I left for something that I think it's more fulfilling to me personally, because I get to tell the stories about why this is happening. And that's where I'm coming at in this conversation. And I'm thinking back to a lot, you know, I think this was, what year was this? This was pre-pandemic. I was at an event at Neiman with a bunch of other environmental reporters. I don't know if Alex Harris is in here, but she was one of them. And we were told by a speaker that we shouldn't use the word crisis to describe what's happening, because it scares people and it turns them off. And I think just thinking back to that moment where that person got a lot of pushback from the audience, and there was still a lot of division then, though. There were a lot of reporters in the audience who were like, yeah, we shouldn't do that. That's, you know, that's going to make us political. It's going to make us part of what's happening, like, this conversation, this fight. But I was really just so inspired by the other reporters who I heard say, yes, we have to communicate how bad this is. It's not our job to sugarcoat it. It's not our job to make people feel better about it. It's great to present solutions, but we have to be like really, really clear about what's happening. And I'm just thinking about how much things have changed since that event and trying to consider where are we going to be in 3 or 4 or 5 years and what is the conversation that we need to be having right now about how tough and how adversarial we need to be and how clear we need to be about how bad things are while still being fair, while still presenting the pros and cons of possible solutions, and while still, you know, having space in our stories for the industries that we're writing about, but being really critical of what it is that they're presenting to the public about what they're doing. So that's why I'm here, and I think everyone here has a similar but different kind of trajectory of their career and like why they started thinking about this more. And I hope that a lot of people had a chance to read Sammy's recent newsletter piece on this. And so, Sammy, could you introduce yourself and talk about that piece and how it came to be and why you wanted to be part of this conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. Can people hear me?
It feels like you can't, but yeah.
That's so bizarre. And thanks for asking me to be a part of this and talking about the column. A couple of things. So, you know, I wasn't at the dinner last night, but you were talking, you know, asked the question, why, you know, what is your job as a journalist? And, you know, to just be super cliched and big picture, but also, you know, a little egotistical. I mean, I think it's to make the world a better place. I mean, that would be how I would put it. I was reminded, as you were saying that, I don't know if anyone recalls this, but it was right, I think, before the pandemic started. I hate to pick on one reporter, so I won't name him, but there was a reporter at the New York Times who covers politics, I'm sure everyone has heard of, who was talking right in March 2020 about how he tries so hard to show that he's not on either side that he doesn't even vote in elections. And that made my blood boil, like a few other things, because it's like, I am in this, and so many of you in this room, I'm sure, are in this, probably everyone, because it's like, we care so badly about what's going to happen and what kind of world we're going to help, you know, make. And, you know, if you don't even vote, what does that say about you? I mean, that's, to me, the opposite of what journalists ought to be, you know, how we ought to be engaging with the world. You know, we're active participants in this, whether we like it or not. I cover the energy beat for the LA Times, which was traditionally much more of a business beat at this newspaper. And I came to it consciously from a climate perspective. So, I mean, I studied sustainable development in college. I studied climate science and took classes in, you know, law and politics and engineering and all sorts of stuff. And so I went in. First job was covering energy for a newspaper in Palm Springs called The Desert Sun, which was also a really good grounding in this stuff, because in the desert in California where I was doing that job, this was like the epicenter of the solar industry in the United States. So like the first really big solar farms in the U.S. were getting built like as I was covering energy in the desert. If you've ever driven from L.A. to Palm Springs, if anyone's been out there, you drive through all of the wind turbines in the mountains. That was like the first spot that wind power was developed in a big way in the U.S. So that was kind of my grounding. And, you know, so I came in with the climate background and thinking, like, wow, renewable energy is really a real thing. Like, you know, it's here. People have this. So it, you know, coming into the beat at the L.A. Times, it just felt so obvious. Like, this is a beat about the, you know, how energy is going to transition and, you know, how we're going to tackle the climate crisis. And, you know, I use that language all the time. I don't think anyone really has a good idea of what, you know, what kind of language or what type of stories resonate with audiences and what doesn't. I mean, there's research on that, but I always think that there are different stories that resonate with different people. And the best stories that I can do are the ones that I'm good at and the ones that I, you know, feel like I'm able to write the way that I can write them. So I don't think too hard about, you know, is this the right messaging or not? I mean, to me, that's one of the differences. You know, as an activist or an advocate, you know, you're thinking really hard about how do I message this to people, and, you know, what is the best communication strategy for, you know, convincing them or getting my point across. Whereas, you know, I'm just trying to tell stories that are going to make an impact somehow. I mean, it's a different way of thinking about things. So, you know, I don't know that I answered your question or not. I mean, I you know, when I got to writing this piece, getting personal about the climate crisis or whatever we titled it, I just thought that. You know, I see that there are a lot of journalists who are covering this stuff that seem to be moving in this direction of, you know, being an active participant and making solutions. And I just thought that, you know, it's important for readers to understand that that's where we're coming from, because that'll build trust and that'll build credibility for us. I mean, this was the thing that made me crazy about the New York Times reporter said he didn't vote. I mean, that's the kind of thing that would make me, you know, to never trust a word the person writes, because, like, you know, do you even care about any of this? Like, I want people to know that I care and where I'm coming from. And, you know, if the industry is going to criticize stuff that I write, that's going to happen regardless. You know, I'd rather be upfront about where I'm coming from and sort of, in some ways, even immunize myself from bad faith criticism.
So, and just briefly, did you hesitate to write that? Did you worry when it published? How did you, how did you feel about it? And like,
no.
How did, would you have a few years ago?
Yeah, a few years ago I would have, but you know, I've gotten more confidence in where it is and where I'm coming from. And I've got editors who are supportive, and frankly, I didn't think it would be that big a surprise to anyone who had followed my work.
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't quite do, you know, what you do in the same way that you do. It's a little bit different, a little bit less adversarial, I would say. But you know, the companies and you know the oil and gas companies that I write about, you know, they know where I'm coming from. They've read my work. You know, I'm fair to them as best as I can be when they've got legitimate points to make or arguments that, you know, are based in fact. I include those in my stories. But, you know, I've not shied away from using language that shows, like, yes, that, you know, climate is a crisis and we need to solve it. And, you know, I'm writing stories that are trying to help push that along. So I don't think it was that big a shock to anyone. I just said it in more direct ways than I had before.
Right. Well, I know a lot of people appreciated it and it sparked a conversation. So I'm really glad that you did that. I was thinking too, so I'm writing in a notebook here, it's for First Solar, and I was just thinking about, you know, when I started doing journalism a decade ago, I would have been terrified to write in this or carry it anywhere, right? Because I would think that people would think, like, oh, like Emily's a shill for First Solar, but she has a notebook by them. Obviously I'm not, and I think that just that alone really says something about how things have shifted and our understanding of how we can communicate things about what we care about, and we can be nuanced, and we can have opinions, express opinions, and keep them separate from our work.
You say the First Solar notebook? I mean, when I was out in the desert in California, there were plenty of negative stories about, you know, big solar farms that were built with First Solar panels causing environmental harm. So it's like you got to be open and honest about problems with the solutions too. It goes both ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that leads me to Sarah, because I think you've done some research and you've been following how reporters' feelings about objectivity have evolved over time and how we treat it. I was interested in your thoughts about that. Why that's changed, how that's changed.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm Sarah Shipley Hiles. I'm a faculty member at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. And before I became a faculty member, I was a professional journalist, and I think I'm really of a different generation than some folks here. So I have kind of a long history, but I've also studied the history of objectivity. And I became really interested in this when I was working as a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. This was like right around 2000, and you know, at that time, I was fairly new to covering climate. You know, this was a while ago now. And I was working in a very traditional newsroom. And I remember that my editor told me, as I was writing this one story, that I needed to include the other side in my story. Mm-hmm. And by that, he meant at that time, you know, these professional skeptics who were very much part of shaping the climate conversation at that time. Mm-hmm. And I was very surprised because rarely did my editor ever tell me what to do and who I needed to talk to for a story. And I kind of pushed back against that, but not wanting to get into a big knockdown with my editor at the time and not having a lot of knowledge about what was happening behind the scenes, I did go ahead and quote some of those skeptics in my piece. But it bothered me a lot. And so fast forward a couple of years later, in 2004, there was a big academic paper by Boykoff and Boykoff that came out called Balance is Bias. And that was like a bombshell in the journalism field because basically it exposed that, you know, what you refer to as the prestige press, which are like the major newspapers of the country, were covering climate change like a 50-50 argument rather than, you know, following what science already knew at that time, which there was already a clear consensus even back then. So in 2004, that lie was really exposed. And journalists, myself included, felt horrible, you know? There we were trying to, like, do our best to be fair, to be balanced, you know, and we had really been played as an industry. So there was this kind of radical, you know, questioning of what are we doing here, and of course, there were some very good investigative books written around that time. Naomi Oreskes did a fabulous book called Merchants of Doubt that y'all really have to read, and you have to watch the documentary Merchants of Doubt, which is available on streaming, and I love it, which really goes into depth about the... And I think probably everybody here is fairly familiar with the whole playbook that the fossil fuel industry followed, that the tobacco industry had developed in order to... You don't have to convince people that something isn't true, you just have to plant doubt in their minds. Mm-hmm. And that is how they were able to manufacture doubt. And the media played into that game, sadly. And so journalists are partly responsible for the climate crisis. And really, I've spent the past 20 years kind of doing penance and sort of, researching this issue, because I really wondered, how did we get caught in this trap? Anyway, later on then I decided to go into academia and teaching, and I really got into research and trying to understand this. And I think it's important for people to know that objectivity as a concept has really evolved over time. So the first iteration of objectivity was an attempt to sell newspapers. So basically, at one point in the history of this country, newspapers were pretty much operated by political parties. And then the penny press came around, and the idea was these newspapers are going to be sold for a penny apiece to the common person, and we need it to appeal to everybody. So we're not going to have these political perspectives. So that was where the idea of objectivity first came into being. And then that sort of became more popular, and the thinking was that there is an objective truth. The development of photography, you can take a picture of something, and that is reality. Mm-hmm. All of these things in our human development and technology development led into the belief that objectivity was a real thing. And then starting really World War II, that began to collapse, and people began to see that lies were being told by the government, and they began to question if we can trust what official sources of information are telling us. And so really from there on, the idea of a single truth that can be questioned fell apart. But journalists were still eager to represent truth. And so they tried really hard to kind of hold on to this idea of objectivity. And especially in environmental journalism, if you study the history of this organization of environmental journalism, that really came about in the 70s. That was a time when the environmental movement was growing and environmental journalism was growing, and people felt they needed to separate themselves from being environmentalists. They were environmental journalists. And so objectivity was kind of this shield that people used to gain credibility and to separate themselves from the activists in the field. Years later, again, that question, that notion came under serious challenge, and I think climate change is the thing that prompted a lot of that. The Boykoff and Boykoff study, prompted that, and I did some research interviewing longtime environmental journalists who lived through that era and how they changed their own concept of what objectivity is all about. And basically, they rejected the notion that there is any such thing as pure objectivity, but they still wanted their methodology to be objective, kind of scientific method of reporting. And that sounds like a good idea, but there's also a problem with that, which is inherent bias. And so even a few years later after that, I think the idea of objectivity has been further blown up by, conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and our realization that even if we're trying to be objective in our methods, we all come to things with a particular perspective informed by our backgrounds and our experiences and our station in life and so forth and so forth. And so there's been some really deep, reconsideration again around the idea of objectivity and a recognition that objectivity has, served power structures. Mm-hmm. And, especially people of color, poor people have been undermined greatly by this idea, of objectivity, that we have to, follow these official sources and be neutral and so on and so forth. Who is that really serving? Mm-hmm. It's not serving the people, it's serving the power structures that exist. So there's a really good book that a podcast that I would recommend to you called The View from Somewhere, Undoing the Myth of Journalistic Objectivity by Lewis Raven Wallace. If y'all haven't heard it or read it, I really recommend that. And that goes deep into exploring this idea about objectivity as a problematic structure, that serves power and does a disservice to, communities that have been underrepresented. So that's some of my research and why I think this is interesting. I'm really thankful to be here with you all discussing it.
I wanted to note a quote that really stood out to me yesterday from the Solutions Journalism panel from Cheryl Dale, with the Solutions Journalism Network, who said that advocating nothing is advocating for the status quo. Mm-hmm. And I've been really thinking about that. And when we talk about advocating, I'm not talking about taking various energy solutions over others. I think advocating for a response, like a real response to climate change.
Yeah, I want to add one thing. So I think environmental journalists have been all tied up about this, and done ourselves into knots. But if you think about other fields of reporting, it's like political reporters don't have to pretend that they're not in favor of democracy. That's just a given. It's understood that we're in favor of that. And an education reporter can, be in favor of education. I think education is a good thing. We can all agree about that. So why is it so controversial to say that we're in support of a clean environment? It's really not. We just put ourselves into that box over the years.
I also want to come back to, after we hear from Justin, what you said about reporters realizing that they had been caught in a trap, because I really worry that we are currently caught in a different kind of trap in the way that we're representing the information that we're getting from industry and what they're doing to respond, and politicians. Justin?
Well, I'll be
fairly... Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I was going to say, I can just introduce myself and...
Yeah, and how you come at the question of objectivity, the kind of work you do.
Yeah. So I'm Justin Welland. I'm the senior correspondent at Time. I've been on the climate beat since 2015. And I guess I would say, had a similar experience, I think, to what Emily shared coming on to the beat, doing a lot of the same stories that everyone was doing and really looking for a way to both sort of break through that noise, but also tell stories that are actually meaningful and get to the heart of the problem, and to what Sammy said, to make the world a better place by allowing people to have the same sort of awakening and understanding the implications of climate change that I had when I took on that beat. And so I've explored lots of different ways of telling stories that, as I say, sort of reach out to where people are, whether that be on-the-ground storytelling, whether that be trying to tell stories that are climate-related, that relate to the news of the day. I think the main thing I would say, to get to the objectivity point, is, I approach climate from a point of, how do I look at this analytically? How can I look at what is the actual work, the facts on the ground? What is the truth that, I'm not making, but I'm assessing using all of the facts available? And that is the fine line, that is the line between advocacy and journalism. And so, as has been said before, if we have to advocate for, doing something. And for me, the point that I always make to anybody who accuses me of being an activist, whether that's, editors who are skeptical or people on Twitter, is saying, look, I'm looking at all the facts, and they're here, and you can look at them yourself. I'm making a reasoned assessment because, the facts are pretty clear. And I'm saying, here are a range of different solutions. And I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'll tell you, this has this drawback, and this one has this positive thing, et cetera, and you can make a decision there, but I'm presenting this all to you. I have lots of other things I can say, but I'll just leave it there, and we'll get into the discussion.
Thank you. I wanted to talk a little bit about what's changed most recently. It'd be really weird if we didn't talk about the Trump administration on this panel. And also just what we've learned about the severity of the crisis, how public acceptance of climate change has changed. I think we're all kind of to a point where we understand that we're not writing for people who completely deny that it's happening. We probably can't reach those people. But we are still writing for a lot of people who are somewhere in the middle, who know there's a problem, they don't know how concerned to be, they don't know what needs to be done, they're not really sure how they're involved. So what have you seen in the past few years that has shaped how you think about how you're communicating this to readers?
Well, I mean, maybe Sarah or Justin want to talk about the Trump administration, but I mean, in California, the big thing has just been like, it's just gotten so obvious what's happening. I mean, we had a fire in 2018 that destroyed a whole town and killed 85 people. We've had record fire seasons pretty much every year in, year out now. Heat waves like we've not seen before, power outages because it's so hot and there's not enough electricity to keep the lights on. Gosh, drought, now we're in year three of another drought. It's one of the worst ever. We just got out of one of the droughts that was one of the worst ever a couple years ago. It's, I think writing for an audience in California and the western U.S. in particular, where the fire and drought and heat threats have gotten so bad, people just get it in a way that they didn't before, the thing that I'm writing about, because they've been living this reality. And yeah, obviously there are versions of that everywhere. I think some of the impacts have been particularly severe in California recently, but I think that's the big thing that's changed. I mean, the politics are another one, but the reality has just become so obvious to most people.
Yeah, and the numbers, I like to look at these, every 6 months or so from the Yale Climate Change Communication Program, and they do this in a range of six types of beliefs, so like alarmed, concerned, cautious about the climate crisis. And disengaged, doubtful, dismissive. Doubtful and dismissive are only 19% of people polled now, which is so much lower than it used to be. Yeah. And I think that really has to play into how we're communicating to people. And Sarah, I'm interested in your thoughts on, because I did quote people who denied that climate change is happening during the Trump campaign and during the Trump administration, because they're part of the administration that were making policy. How has that changed how we think about this? I think that we saw reporters get much more aggressive and adversarial during the Trump campaign and administration, and then I think I've seen that scale back a little bit, and I'm concerned about that because I don't think that we see the Biden administration doing the things that they promised to do on climate or achieving those.
The media was reacting to outright lies, and there were conversations about, can we call this a lie? Like, can we use that word and call this person a liar?
There was literally, like, NPR, I believe, had a big internal discussion, at least that's what I saw from Twitter, from reporters there.
Yeah, exactly.
About when that's appropriate,
Exactly. So, there's still a lot of hesitation about being able to call a lie, and when do we know something is a lie, and what is that, there's a lot of connotations to that word. So I do think, that administration, kind of encapsulated this age that we're living in where people can outright deny the truth, and that does put journalists in a difficult situation because, if we are reporting on what we think is the truth and certain people are going to react to that and go into conspiracy mode, it makes it that much more difficult for reporters to do their work. And I do think that we have to be conscious of how the public receives our messages. We spend a lot of time in academia researching the science of science communication and how do people, even the term climate change can be a turnoff to some people. So it's interesting to see how reporters have and journalists have kind of shifted on that over time to be more aware. I think I try to be aware of what the science of science communication is telling us and different ways that we can nuance our stories to try to reach people in a more receptive way. But I think the political changes have kind of forced us in a position that we have to recognize, this problem still goes on, that there are going to be people who deny these truths, and we are in a position to either quote them or not quote them. How do we situate them in our stories? Facts after their quotes. And understanding that the more that we do give airtime to those kinds of perspectives, that it will, you know, amplify those perspectives, whether we like it or not. So it does put us in a very difficult situation. And I don't think that that's going to change anytime soon, because while the majority of people are now concerned about climate change, there's a portion who remain very skeptical of it.
I've been really surprised in my conversations with journalists about how much range there is about how much we think we should know about our audience, how much we should think about our audience, how much we should consider how they're receiving the messages that we put out. I think even on this panel, we have differing opinions of that. I want to know as much as possible, and there are so many things going on in a person's head and so many influences we know from social science that affect what they believe about the world and how it works and what it means for them. So that's really incredibly hard, but I think we're learning a lot more than we ever have before and how much to balance those things. And I think we have a lot of discussions about how much to write about solutions. And Justin, how much does your work get into that, and how much do you know about your readers, one? How much do you think about that, two? And three, like, when you're writing a story, do you consider, like, is this going to make people sad? Should we consider that?
Okay, how much do I know? How much do I think about it?
Yeah.
Do I care about making people sad?
Yeah, it's a big one. You're taking on a lot of work on this panel.
Yeah. I work for a national news outlet, so it's a particular circumstance. I think, you know, we do know, you know, a decent amount, sort of an aggregate about our readers. Mm-hmm. And also that, you know, every story for us can have a completely different, you know, sort of set of readers who find the story and engage with it. So, you know, I can tell you what our median meter is, but that's not necessarily all that relevant when, you know, you might write one story that just lights up a particular community or a particular place. And I guess that brings me to the second point, which is how much do I think about about those readers, and I would say not all that much. I mean, in the sense that as long as there is an audience, you know, as long as the story will activate some community or some group of people who are interested, I don't particularly, care who it is. I think there are ways in which we care, in the sense that I write for, you know, a magazine, 10,000 word stories, so you have to write accessibly, and it comes in that way, but it's not, you know, I'm not. So one thing I would say is I try to make my stories, particularly the longer form things, have some sort of insight or something that would be interesting to people who follow the climate or the area I'm writing about, somewhat deeply, that they would find something interesting and also be accessible enough that a sort of everyday reader would engage in it. And then making people sad. I mean, this debate, I think, is really interesting, and it's one that I don't ignore it, but I don't really, it doesn't really guide my work. I think, you know, the important thing to me is engaging people, as I was saying earlier, finding ways to activate them so that they're interested and engaged. And I think sometimes that means scaring them, because it is scary, and sometimes there are interesting solutions to write about that also, to link the two when they can be linked. So if there is a story about a really crazy problem, and there also are a range of solutions that could be implemented, you gotta pair them both together, or else you're not telling a complete story. So I answered your questions.
Yes.
Did I answer it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I just want to say, I mostly agree with what Justin said, and that's how I approach my job too, but you know, this and what doesn't. I do think that's valuable. I guess what I sort of am thinking on that is that I try not to let myself get too tied up in knots, mm-hmm. thinking about what's going to work and what doesn't. But similar to Justin, it's hard to know exactly who your audience is or might be for any given story. So I mean, I've done stories that have resonated with different audiences by provoking outrage or by taking a dark moment and trying to put a hopeful, you know, solutions-oriented spin on it, or by taking a dark moment and saying here's why it's even worse than it seems. First done that have resonated with different audiences in ways that I might not have expected. And so I just spend a lot more time thinking about, you know, what stories am I uniquely positioned to tell by virtue of, you know, where I am geographically, what my expertise is, who I know, what my style is, and, you know, what are the high impact stories that I'm in a position to tell, rather than worrying too much about is it going to make people sad or is it going to make people hopeful, those kinds of things.
I think I come at it a little differently because I really want to reach people who don't already know what's happening and who like don't already get it, who aren't engaged. Like I worry a lot about preaching to the choir and where your work is appearing and how much range and flexibility you have. And so I know that's not an easy thing to do, to like try to specifically reach people who are in that place. But we have a little more ability to do it because we publish in a lot of different kinds of places. And I think we're often bringing stories to people that the kinds of stories they haven't heard before about not just how things are and how bad the situation is, but why are we here? That's required because of climate change is hard. It's that there are people making money off of not doing it, and they're fighting it. I hope that that's, all of our stories are really focused on that. And I think I hope that reaches people in a different way and reaches readers who don't even necessarily see it as a climate change story, right? They see it as what it is that they have been misled repeatedly, that there are things happening behind the scenes that they weren't aware of, that there are campaigns to influence the people who are supposed to be representing them in government happening.
I want to add one more thing on this if I can. So,
and then we'll go to questions if people can get those ready.
I want to put on my other hat for a second. Yeah. So we have this new project called the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk. And I've been thinking a lot more about this because our area is the Mississippi River Basin, which is right in the heart of America. And we're going to be writing about agriculture. And you know, within the farming community, climate change is still a very controversial topic among some people, not everybody. But we're very interested in reaching those audiences, of reaching rural people, reaching farmers, and having that conversation about climate change and about, you know, environmental impacts. And so it is really important to me to think deeply about, you know, not only how are we going to reach those people as sources, but how are we going to reach them as an audience, and how are we going to have that conversation?
So questions, we're going to go to journalists and SEJ members first. Yeah? And you were at our dinner last night.
Yes, I was.
Can you introduce yourself, please, too?
Yes, so I'm Hannah Bernstein. I work with the Earth Journalism Network. We're a journalism grant funder. We mostly work internationally. You mentioned Lewis Regan Wallace, who is also a favorite of mine to follow. And before he did all the cool things that he's been doing, he was fired from NPR's Marketplace. He's a trans journalist, and he was fired for saying that Objectivity is dead and kind of questioning the difficulties of covering the Trump administration as a trans person. And so I'm curious, pushing back against this kind of methodology and objectivity can be really dangerous for especially journalists who are already vulnerable to these kinds of things. If we believe objectivity, the way we're looking at it, is wrong, what can we do about it in a way that doesn't jeopardize our jobs, I guess?
Yeah. And it can be dangerous not just professionally, but personally.
Yes.
And I want to be really clear that I don't want to push people to do anything that's going to make them feel unsafe, ever. And I know we're all in a very different situation in our workplace, but I think we have to support each other and to explain to, you know, editors and people on other beats like why we're doing this and why maybe it looks a little bit differently than it has previously.
I wanted to say briefly, I mean, I think framing it in language that is accessible to the person you're talking to. And so we all know editors who might be, of a different generation mindset. And so the way I would approach it is to say, you know, sort of what I was saying earlier, which is, okay, if I am going to be a quote-unquote neutral observer here, let's look at the facts, let's look at, what this means, and then just present it in a way that they can grapple with, rather than, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, I wouldn't necessarily, and I'm not faulting the journalists, I wouldn't say, you know, objective war is clearly a value that any, you know, humane person would have, and nobody's going to disagree with that. I sort of just fumbled around there, but I think what I'm saying is just try to reach the person in a way that they can, in language they can really take it in, because I think a lot of what we're talking about can be framed in different ways that can reach people who might be skeptical on the onset. Yeah.
And I think even like what you said about being a neutral observer, I think the shift is a little bit to being a fair observer, an ethical observer. It's like what we're seeing is not neutral.
Well, and right, and so what I guess what I mean by neutral is neutral with the assumption, this is all about language, it's neutral with the assumption that you are a humane person. Because yeah. if you are a neutral observer of, say, a Russian invasion of Ukraine, that doesn't mean that you are neutral. It means that, you know, a neutral observer sees that this is an injustice that's being perpetrated.
I would say it's really important for people who have some privilege to be allies. And it's really important for them to start these conversations in their newsrooms and to really set about, you know, transforming the newsroom culture, transforming what we cover, how we cover it, who's on our staff. And it's really up to people who have the privilege to start leading those conversations. So I've been working on a diversity tracking, source tracking project, you know, with my students in our newsrooms for writing for what are we doing. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you're covering science and environmental fields and you are trying to have, you know, sources that represent the diversity of the population, you're going to find out very quickly that in the STEM fields, you know, it's very white. And so then you have to ask questions about why and who do I consider to be an expert. And then you also have to ask questions about what kinds of stories are we covering. And those conversations should be happening at the newsroom level. Mm-hmm. So that should be a topic of conversation. And the people who are able to have those conversations safely should be leading them. Mm-hmm. And editors, you know, some of them are old school and they need to be brought along. They need to be educated. So, you know, having a little webinar, having a little, you know, lunch session, so let's talk about some of these things, and they can see the writings and the books and the podcasts and, you know, the many articles that have been written, you know, that can be a place to start for people who haven't been exposed to this kind of thing before. But it's really important that the whole weight of this not come down on the, you know, people of color or the trans issue. You know, are you too concerned about, you know, the environment? You know, are you too concerned about the issues of Black America? We can't allow you to cover, you know, the protests anymore because you're Black. You can't cover the protests. I mean, that has happened too. So those kinds of things expose a real structural problem in newsrooms that we really have to work on.
But I think like there's a moment when the public is going to catch up to us, and I'm really hoping that we get there far before them, and help with that, and then we don't get stuck in a trap again. Right.
Yeah.
And I know it's hard, but I think everyone has to think about it and communicate in the small ways, the smaller big ways that they can. Like it's a risk for me even to have organized this panel and say what I'm saying here, right? Like we work with a lot of legacy news organizations, and in my conversations with most of the editors there, but also some of the reporters, I've like realized there's a really big range in how people think about this. But when it comes down to it, we collaborate and we are allied to do the reportings. We have the same, like, we still see the stories as valuable in the same way. We still think that they need to be told.
But, I mean, I think I just want to basically end our careers, like, we you know, have the responsibility to say the stuff we're thinking out loud and sort of shift the Overton window on these issues. I mean, that's, you know, that's part of the reason why I wrote the piece a couple months ago about, you know, my experience covering climate and how I approach it, because I know that I have added this and putting it out there. It helps to bring other people along and sort of shift how people think about stuff so that it's not, you know, not so hard for everyone.
Right, and you said, like, that was probably not a surprise to anyone what you wrote, but it probably was to a lot of journalists in, like, other parts of the country and different jobs.
Yeah, I mean, it was for covering climate
for
news,
your readers,
so that was really the audience I was thinking about there, is how to bring other journalists along.
Absolutely, right.
Covering Climate News is also a great organization if people don't know about it.
One in the very back. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes, you. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Erin with the Texas Tribune. Sammy, I think you were saying that was traditionally a beat on the business desk at your newsroom. Mm-hmm. And I've been in newsrooms in the past where energy reporters on the business desk are sort of separate from the environment and climate reporters on the metro desk. And I was curious, like, when you came to that beat, like, what conversations did you have in the newsroom to sort of change that institutional structure of the separation between like a business energy beat and a climate beat and cover it?
We never really had much of a conversation about it. I just kind of started doing it. you know, again, I was somewhat fortunate in the fact that I had editors who were willing to go along with it, but I kind of think with, you know, with big institutions, small institutions too, but, you know, with any kind of bureaucracy or power structure, it's like sometimes there's just an argument for just doing it differently mm-hmm. rather than trying to, you know, like have a conversation about it first or, you know, shift these institutions that can be, you know, slow and plodding and traditional and hard to shift, like, you know, done, but I just, you know, I knew that wasn't what I wanted, and I just gradually started doing it differently to the point where it was like, you know, they started asking me, hey, like, you know, this is when the environment team meets, like, you should really come and, you know, meet with the environment. It was sort of obvious, and I showed that it worked. I mean, there was an audience for the types of stories I was telling people and reading them, but wasn't that always how it was done? It's like, no, I had to shift it, but then, you know, attempting to change the institution before you just do it.
Yeah. By all means, please don't go back to your newsrooms and tell them they're doing it wrong.
That doesn't go well. Just start showing them that these types of stories work.
Show, don't tell. Right. And I think if this is more of a thought exercise, like we're beginning the process here, right? I think a really good thing to do is, and I've done this, look back at your stories, like look back at a year of stories, and even if you just read the headlines and ask yourself, like, is that what I meant to do? Right? Like, did I tell people the things I meant to tell people? Am I portraying what's actually happening to them, or did I get caught up in the day-to-day and miss that overall message that I'm trying to get to people? I think you were first, and then we'll come back this way.
Yeah, my name is Dogger. I mostly write for the Texas Observer, and I'm wondering if you guys have any advice for those of us who live and work in red states, especially where so many people are dependent on the oil and gas industries. I struggle a lot with, like, you know, trying to get across the severity and the gravity of environmental issues, but also having, you know, concern and empathy for jobs and economic mm-hmm. situations. And I also feel like, you know, here in Texas, we are still living in a version of Trump world, and like, we're dealing with like, we're not looking at government officials a lot and having to take the perspective because that is the reality. So, like, just how an advice would be great.
We think in a red state and where a lot of people who are reading you work in like oil and gas jobs, like, how are you sensitive to that? Is that sort of, and we have a full-time reporter in Louisiana who writes a lot about the workforce, the oil and gas workforce, and one of the things she's been covering, Sarah Sneath, is how underreported offshore oil and gas deaths are, and how when those workers are injured or die offshore, they have very little recourse. Their families can't really do anything because of the way U.S. law is set up. And I think one of the things that's really important to remember is that people who work for the industry are not always aligned with everything that the industry wants, right? Like, the workers themselves are not the industry. They're not who I'm talking about when I'm talking about corporations and what they're lobbying for. It is, but I think, would you
want to? Oh, yeah, I'll jump in on just one of the last things you said about talking to officials, and I think this came up earlier just with regard to the Trump administration, and I think it's really important to talk to a range of people, even if they're wrong, objectively.
if they're saying those things,
we have this immense power of not quoting it, you know, and including perspective when it's relevant, when you can use that to then go back and verify, you know, sometimes it might be worth quoting it if it's egregiously wrong that you can say, this person said this, and here are the facts, you know, and this is, I mean, so I am a huge believer in continuing to talk to a range of people if they'll talk to you. But the sensitivity question is I think a little more difficult, and I think primary thing where they're coming from, and I think come and correct people, and they, you know, try to have a not contentious, but it's sort of like you're wrong. And there's no value in doing that, especially with somebody who's just a, you know, everyday person. I would try to reach them where they are and just say, hey, what are you, you know, I just want to have a conversation.
The only thing I would just quickly add here in Texas, and I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but I mean, renewable energy is just such a huge story here. I mean, I think Texas is adding probably more wind and solar every year than any other state at this point, just in terms of volume. And so I think telling those stories is a good way to show not only, you know, alternative source of energy, but also, you know, an alternative source of jobs and economic activity. Like, that doesn't exactly solve your question, but I think, you know, it's just one really good way to show that there's more than oil and gas.
And it's hard to tell people that the science shows their job should go away, right? My dad works in the oil and gas industry. He inspects refineries and chemical plants, install solar panels. It's a completely different job, right? And it's wrong for us to suggest that it's the same. But what we can do is have a conversation about, you know, well, then why aren't your policymakers helping us to figure out what comes next, you know? Because otherwise we just stop at the argument of, but the jobs are important. Like, obviously, yes, they are, but there are people who are in charge of figuring out how to make this fair, and they aren't really doing a great job.
I'll just real quickly add, I think it's important, and one of my goals is to avoid, you know, the constant framing of things as conflicts between jobs and the environment. Jobs and the environment, that is such a false dichotomy. Also, like, environmentalists and farmers, always on opposite sides. No, you know, I'm not going to frame a story that way. So try to look for stories that don't always have those kinds of conflict frames. It could be a solution story, but it might be a science story, or it might be somebody doing something unexpected, but there are a lot of ways that you can cover things that don't always fall back on the same entire, you know, framing of things as a conflict over the environment.
And also look at the numbers. Sarah's been finding that the number of people actually employed by the industry has been really been going down in recent years, but they're still making the same argument that they're, I think we had, right over here.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Hogue with Chemical and Engineering News. And Sarah, you brought up the question about the issue of tracking our sources and diversity, which my newsroom has been doing. It kind of came up organically. We all wanted to do it. We have a problem with tracking. We can do usually gender, but it's difficult to do with a racial thing, because do I assume that a person who seems to look like an African-American and I talk to on the phone and I can see their website, or do we ask them? And our question about this is, you know, it's not relevant to our story. It's a bigger issue. How do you and your students do that, and how do you do it in a way that is, you know, I don't want to be offensive or asking people for things that aren't relevant to my story.
Yeah. I don't know if you're all familiar with the Open Notebook, which is a really great resource, a website for science journalists, but I've been working with the Open Notebook because, like, we're behind for diversity tracking, and it should have been out by now, because, like, we're behind deadline, but it's going to be out very soon. When it is, I'll make sure to share the link. But it's going to kind of go over a lot of these. People always have concerns about tokenism, which is very valid. You know, you don't want to represent someone as, like, you know, like, why do I have this one person in my story? You know, because they're a person of color. Like, that's tokenizing, right? You want to include sources because they are relevant to the story. So, like, for me, the diversity tracking, to sort of be honest with yourself, and what to be different templates that you can use. So there's different ways of tracking. You might, you could ask your sources on the phone, and you have to get comfortable with, like, you know, telling people we are tracking, you know, our sources because we, for internal purposes, and I'm going to store it safely and all this kind of stuff. Or you could use, like, an after-interview survey that you send to people and let that maybe fill out. Kind of Googling and guessing is not really recommended, because you're, you know, likely to maybe make mistakes, and also not everything is visible all the time. And so there are different ways of doing it, and different ways of tracking it. You can get into, like, all the different categories and, you know, all of that. But really the point, I think, is to kind of inform the bigger questions about what kinds of stories are we doing, who are we writing for, who's included, are we covering, you know, are we really representing the community in our coverage? So it's just one tool. I don't think it's like the end-all be-all of tools, but it's one tool that for us has proven to be very effective. And also when we do our story pitches, in my classes, the students are required to have a DEI component of every inclusion, whether that's through sourcing, the angle, the topic, whatever the case may be. And for us, you know, we work on a 16-week semester, so at the end of the semester, they have to turn in you know, how they did, and then they have to reflect on that. So we have different discussion points. And I think in newsrooms, in some places this is being deployed too, you know, if you're not going to use that, your findings, then, you know, why are you tracking it in the first place? But it's just a tool for asking questions and, you know, for relating to your community and your audience and trying to figure out where you're going with your coverage.
I think it's art, not science. I don't think we can ever make it science. We did a similar exercise with The Guardian, and I was on figuring out how we would analyze diversity of sources in our stories. And I did not like what I found about my own work. And it was actually when I was doing that exercise that I realized I didn't like the stories I was doing. And I needed to write different kinds of stories to bring in different voices. And that meant shifting away from kind of being with them instead. And it's harder and it takes longer, and you have to advocate for that with your editors. It's not always possible, but
it's,
I think,
better storytelling in the end.
And it
not
keeps you on track.
The story that 15 other people are doing, because it's a unique story.
And it sticks for people, right? And you draw more readers in too, typically.
We find that our narrative leads with real people draw more readers. Right here.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Elizabeth Griffcoff, an environmental health and climate change freelance reporter. This question is based off something Sammy said, but anyone can answer it. So in your work, when a fossil fuel company, a protester, a politician makes a reasonable argument, you know, say about a policy or a large-scale renewable energy project, but you kind of know from past reporting and other things they've said that they're fundamentally opposed to any meaningful climate action or maybe even a climate change denier, I guess I'm just wondering how you kind of properly contextualize that in your
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, the easy answer is I just say it. So, like, you know, I write a lot about the gas utility in Southern California, SoCal Gas, the biggest gas company in the country. And, you know, I quote them in a lot of my stories when I write about them, and, you know, I quote them making points about, gas is cheaper than electricity, or, you know, so with so many, you know, we have so many people employed here who depend on these jobs, or, you know, this is what we're doing to make our pipeline safer. And, you know, what I'll do is I'll say that, but I'll also point out in these stories, you know, this is the company that has, you know, had all of these lobbying efforts against these electrification policies, and this is the company that was just fined $10 million by the state for using ratepayer funds to lobby against climate action. Kind of answered the question and the question, I think, which is that you've got to add that additional context about them. And it's the same on the other side of the equation. Like when I'm quoting a conservation group that has, you know, raising environmental concerns about, you know, a solar farm or a wind farm somewhere, you know, I'm also going to say, and you know, raising these points, they say this project is the bad space, you know, the wrong spot, but you ought to, you know, this group is basically opposed to all of this stuff. I don't know that I wish there was a more, you know, nuanced or complex answer, but I think it is sometimes as straightforward as that.
I do think that, like, sometimes, though, it's appropriate not to include the argument if you think it's a bad faith argument. And I think we talked a bit at the dinner last night about how quoting people who we know have that background, who we know are not actually committed to seeing any kind of transition or story sometimes. So, I mean, I think it's a gut check we have to do, and the more we think about it, the better, but it's really a personal decision.
Well, I mean, one example of that, and I agree with that, talking about the gas company that I cut inside your home and, you know, can contribute to lung conditions and respiratory problems, and the gas company is kind of, you know, I've referenced that in my stories, and they've kind of come back at that and said, well, you know, the research isn't settled, there's really a lot of uncertainty about this, we're not, you know, this is really unknown, and I haven't quoted that because there is science on that, and it is emerging, and, you know, if they wanted to make a nuanced argument about what the science does and doesn't show, that would be one thing, but to just come out and say that, you know, we don't really think this problem exists, there's no science, that's not right, so I haven't put that in my stories.
I was thinking keeping it as brief as possible if you think it's bad faith, right? If you have to include something, make it really short. Space makes a difference. Like, space signals something to our readers about the legitimacy of an argument. Back here, in the very back, yes.
Sorry, thanks for calling. I'm Dan Fagan, and I write and I teach. So I always find the objectivity is dead debate so weird because it implies that objectivity was ever a lie. Everything we know about people is that objectivity is impossible.
Yeah.
But But what is from non-journalists? And it feels like people are just bombarded with these heavily inflected, highly opinionated messages of climate. And to me, there's a real concern about that. Like, there's a long history, noble history of opinion journalism, evidence-based opinion. But the one thing that we can do as journalists that separates ourselves is that we can name names and talk about structural issues and follow the money and do all those great things that journalism do, and even tell people, here are the options. But if we go that extra step of not just here's what we could do, but here's what we should do, it feels like there's something lost. There's potentially something lost in terms of reaching audiences that are not already true believers. So I'm interested in hearing what all of you think about this sort of rise of increasingly inflected journalism, highly opinionated journalism, and what the risks are associated with that.
Yeah. I thank you for that question, because I agree with you. I think that is a problem, and I think we need to really distinguish between the type of journalism I'm talking about that is pointing out the situation we're in, what it means for people, how dire it is, and like the need for action, versus what I see as more like advocacy journalism. I think we need to keep those separate, and I think that we need to be very clear with our readers about which of those types of things we're presenting to them. One of the things that we've seen, I think, is a shift toward, this is, I guess, kind of declined in the past few years, but toward, like, Substack kind of journalism, like reporters who are a brand, who have a newsletter. And I think that's really valuable and has a place, but it's not what I do. And I think that that's, like, a personal question we have to ask ourselves. But I don't think that I should be recommending, like, policy plans. I don't think that I should be advocating for a particular changing fine line. I wrote a piece for The Guardian that was like an expert, it wasn't an opinion piece, but it was like an expert reporter kind of like step back about how, you know, here are five ways that the Biden administration hasn't done the things it said it would do on climate by now. They're not doing enough, right? But I wasn't saying like they should be doing X, Y, and Z. It's taking a stance saying like they're not doing enough, right? But I wasn't saying, like, they should be doing X, Y, and Z. They should be moving forward on this. I was saying they said they would do this thing, and they haven't. And I think there's a clear distinction. But I think we could all benefit by, like, spelling that out for readers. It's like am I an opinion journalist, or am I a news journalist?
Yeah, I think there's a needle to thing for this policy, or a policy, or a solution, and if you are, then you're at, you know, that's the line, in my mind, about where advocacy begins. I think there is some interesting ones where I found myself doing that sort of step back when it comes to, say, Build Back Better, and you sort of led, you know, as sort of what most political needle, but I think at the end of the day, as long as you're not advocating for a policy, that is the line.
Yeah. I think we just need to recognize, too, that there are different types of journalists doing different types of jobs, and we should explain that to people. I think we don't do enough of explaining to people, like, what our job is like behind the scenes. I get questions from family a lot about, like, does your editor tell you what to write? Like, have you ever been censored? Like, you know, like, did anyone ever make you put something false in your story? Like, obviously not, right? But people don't know that. So I think we have to be clear about how we work.
Yeah, I would add that advocacy journalism is journalism, and opinion journalism is journalism, so it's a big tent. There are a lot of ways to do journalism, not just one way. So it really depends on, you know, your specific role. And also, you know, there comes a time when, you know, maybe you have come to a conclusion on something, and by God, you know, if you don't say so, then who are you serving? Yeah. You know, why are you not saying something?
I think we have time for maybe one or two more.
I'll ask one. Tony Barbosa. Yeah, so I was just interested in hearing from the panelists. You know, you talked about this shift that's really happened in the last 2 years, kind of the embrace of the view from somewhere rather than the view from nowhere. I'm just wondering if there's, like, any examples from your reporting that you can think of recently where you approached something differently, wrote it in a different way, focused on something else in a way that you wouldn't have done 5 years ago.
Yeah. Tony, can I ask you something first, though?
Of course, yeah.
So you were the clean air reporter, or the air reporter at the LA Times, right? And you just moved to doing
I switched. I was an air quality reporter on the news side of the LA Times for many years, and last year switched over to the opinion side. Right. So now I'm still reporting on climate and environment, but for the editorial board. Right. So I've been thinking about these issues a lot and the directness of language we use, you know, those sorts of things. But I mean, I'm just really interested in hearing like how you think it's changed, and like if you have examples of like within your stories, like of things you said or done that, you know, that maybe you wouldn't have a few years ago, and kind of how that landed, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think like one obvious one for me is that I try. And I'm editing more than reporting now, or I'm just editing now. But over the past few years, I've tried to really spell out, when I talk about emissions, I try really hard not to call them emissions. I talk about climate pollution, because I think it is a form of pollution. And I try to spell out where it's coming from. What I say is like the result of burning fossil fuels, of burning oil and gas. And one of the things we didn't talk about that I wish we had, but is that like, I think the most effective, but the way that people really absorb journalism is when it's consistent and repeated, when they hear the same thing over time. So like you read the story and then someone talks about it the next day, and then you read another story 4 or 5 days later, or you see it on the news. So I think we have to keep doing that.
I guess one example, and Tony, my apologies if you already know this because you're my colleague, but we had a big oil spill in Southern California 5 or 6 months ago, and it was, you know, it was what everyone was focused on at that moment. And I was asked, you know, as the energy reporter, I wasn't covering the breaking news, but I was, you know, what's your angle on this? What are you going to write about this right now? And I did a piece, the headline and the lead of which were basically, this oil spill is a reminder that, you know, climate change is just the beginning of the harms caused by fossil fuels, and actually, like, you know, this reminds us that it's so much bigger, and there are all of these other, you know, terrible impacts all the time. And then my story, you know, went on and, you know, detailed voices from scientists and policy experts and people who, you know, focus on this stuff and is their expertise explaining that. But I think that's a pretty direct and straightforward and you know, kind of aggressive, but you know, fact-based and I think necessary framing of that, that I would not have had the, you know, the instinct or the, you know, sort of just easiness writing earlier to just go right at it and say, you know, this is what it's, you know, this is the importance of this event, this is what it's telling us.
I think for me too, is writing a nut graph. I think before you write any story, you should know what your nut graph is, which is your, like, why people are reading it. And that's kind of what Sam was talking about. Great.
Of the conferences, I think it's part of a bigger profile, but I sort of just had this moment sitting there where I'm sure many of you maybe have the same sort of cyclical feelings of dread, and it hit me hard for some reason, being in this, like, place where, this beautiful place where people were just talking, and it was like a, and then, so I wrote about the sort of collapse of talks there, and weaving in my sort of sense of dread about the whole thing, and, you know, I think readers do appreciate getting that sense of, like, as Sammy has said and wrote about it, of, you know, there is some emotional investment. And that's not to say, again, not taking a position on anything that was said, other than they need to do more than just talk a lot. So that was a piece where I was a view from somewhere.
I should just quickly add here, the column that I wrote that Emily's referenced a couple times was part of a newsletter that I write called Boiling Point, and I promised my employer I would talk it. LATimes.com/boilingpoint.
It's also linked in our panel description.
Please forgive that.
As things to read.
Exactly.
I'm going to get in trouble with our managing editor because I haven't pointed anyone to Floodlight Newsletter all time, so... We could continue to discuss this. I hope everyone does. That's the intent of this program, is that we spark discussion.